Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This week, that film is 1971's Blind Man, a spaghetti western that stars Tony Anthony as the titular blind gunslinger attempting to rescue 50 women from a Mexican bandit named Domingo, so he can continue to fulfill his noble mission of delivering them safely to their pre-purchased arranged marriages to Texan miners. It's a noble, noble mission. Second billing for the film, however, goes to one Ringo Starr, who plays Domingo's equally villainous brother Candy. And this marks Ringo's first post-Beatles lead role in a film, and one that's quite the departure after his turn in The Magic Christian, released just 2 years before. And it is quite a significant difference from Magic Christian. I was trying to work out, like, if there was any kind of guiding principle that Ringo was trying to follow in terms of how he was going to set about on a new acting career, what might that be that led him to choose a role like Magic Christian followed by a role like Candy in Blind Man? And I couldn't work out, like, you know, what might that be? What might he be thinking? And then I realised that there's one connection between the two roles, which is both films do allow Ringo to have a scene where he is surrounded by lots of naked women.
Yes.
Not saying that's the sole reason why he's chosen these roles.
No, sure,
but it might be a factor.
Yeah, fine. And why not?
Yes, you're Ringo Starr, of course.
Yeah, happy the man who is... Who can spend his professional
his
life.
Job. Yeah, sure. Yeah. But it's quite a departure in the sense that he was a comedy foil and now he's gone to villainous misogynist.
Yep.
Villainous Mexican misogynist, I think is probably a more accurate description.
Yes, yes.
What do we think about Ringo playing against type and playing against his image, I think, for this role?
Well, I mean, I suppose we've been here before in terms of That'll Be the Day, which we talked about last year, where we spoke about, you know, would it have been slightly jarring for audiences to look at the character of Mike that he played in that film, who was not a nice guy, he was a womanizer. And yes, so, I mean, he is kind of like playing against type. But then what is Ringo Starr's type, you know, at this point? Are we talking about the image that he has with the public, or are we talking about him as an actor? You know, I mean, in fact, are they even really two separate things? I suppose when you talk about someone playing against type, so think about, you know, when Robert De Niro started to do comedy roles like Analyze This and Meet the Parents and things like that, he was very much playing against type. Like, nobody expected him to do roles like that.
Yes.
At this point, Ringo. I can hear the hesitation in your voice because you think I'm about to compare Ringo Starr to Robert De Niro.
Well, no, actually, no, not even that. Actually, right. I'm about to compare Robert De Niro to Ringo Starr.
Ah, okay.
In that, Robert De Niro going down the comedy route.
Yeah.
I feel like as justifiable as that decision may be, in hindsight, it's still not Robert De Niro suddenly choosing to play a villainous Mexican misogynist.
No.
Whose first major scene in this film, we should call this out early on, is beating up and raping a woman.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and as you were. Please continue your point.
Thank you very much. I suppose what I'm saying is, like, has Ringo Starr at this point established a type from which to deviate? Does anyone know what that is? Who is Ringo Starr?
Who are any of us, really?
Yeah, exactly.
When I say go against type, I guess I didn't even mean from an acting perspective. I just meant his image. His image as probably the most of the lovable mop tops.
Hmm.
And I realise, you know, obviously the Beatles' career meant that the view of Ringo would have evolved so much over the course of that, you know, those nearly 10 years. But still, I think Ringo was able to maintain a sense of him being like the lovable Beatle with puppy dog eyes.
Yeah. He's the most relatable, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Sort of, you know, one of his primary purposes in the Beatles was to be the one you could relate to. So I suppose it's natural that, you know, if he's going to pursue an acting career, and he's, you know, without doubt the best actor out of the Beatles, if he's going to pursue an acting career afterwards, it's natural that you, if you're mainly familiar with him from the Beatles, that you're going to look for those sort of relatable elements in his performances. Now, and yes, it is probably true to say that in the character of Candy, who is, as aforementioned, a Mexican misogynist who beats up and rapes women, yes, it is quite hard to find
sure, relatable elements.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, maybe that's what he's going for. I mean, you know, actors want to stretch themselves, right? You know.
But also, I mean, actors want to stretch themselves, but this being so early on in his acting career, and we say that as if we know that this was a deliberate attempt on his part to pursue acting as his main career.
Mm-hmm.
So given that idea, it seems to me that maybe choosing to play Candy in this film is him wanting to very early on establish range for himself as an actor.
Yeah.
Because his other roles have all been either roles in the Beatles or sort of quirky 60s sex comedies, which is, I think, what we unfairly labelled Magic Christian as in our episode on that. But yes, but, you know, I mean, it's a massive departure, but I suppose, you know, this is maybe the first chance he has, or, you know, he wants to put his first foot forward in the world of acting, and it needs to be a credible choice, not just Ringo Starr playing a version of Ringo Starr.
Yeah. And bear in mind too that Ringo always loved cowboys and always loved, you know, westerns. You know, it's a big part of his personality. You know, like his love for country music. Before he got in the Beatles, I think he was trying to sort of emigrate to America. You know, I'm not sure if it's going to be like a ranch hand or something like that. But I think that was kind of in his mind. Like, you know, I think there was some kind of admin thing with him filling out the wrong form, which meant he couldn't go or something like that. I forget what it was, but it was something along those lines. But yeah, like, and, you know, him doing sort of country songs like Act Naturally, you know, it's all part of, and, you know, Don't Pass Me By, of course, you know, sort of very country tinge. That's sort of, it's where his heart is, you know. He will have really wanted to do a Western, for sure.
And you would expect then for his love of cowboys, his love of Westerns and cowboys, that his first role might be as a cowboy.
Yeah.
And not as a villainous Mexican misogynist. Like it would, but also, you know, no one's to hammer that point home, but like his Ringo Starr, presumably he would have easily been able to find a vehicle that would allow him to be the hero of the story. And set out in, you know, in the world in that way, as opposed to this, it's second billing in the film, but actually, it's not probably the character with the second most amount of screen time in the film.
Yeah,
and he's brother of main villain.
Yeah,
it's an interesting choice. I mean, it feels like maybe he's dipping his toe in the water a little bit, but also having to prove himself more so than some of the other acting choices that we've covered.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, but I think at this point, you know, I wonder how much cachet he has as an actor to be able to, certainly as a star, he has a fair amount of cachet, and actually, like, the music he's releasing commercially is, like, doing pretty well. Like, he and George, at this point, are probably the two most commercially successful ex-Beatles, you know, 71 going into 72, around that time. But yeah, in terms of film roles, you know, I'm not sure he would have had the opportunity, or I'm not sure he could have been able to manufacture the opportunity easily enough to go off and be the star in a Western.
Yeah, maybe. It's interesting, isn't it? Because you'd expect that to be really easy now. You'd expect, like, any of the Beatles to be able to walk into whatever they wanted to do next. But maybe, right. You're right, maybe, you know, it's a different world at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
We know, obviously, that so the film is produced by Alan Klein. We know that Alan Klein, having taken on the role of managing the Beatles, would have, and obviously did, lobby hard for Ringo to get this role, because it's what Ringo would have wanted. And I think it's fair to say that Alan Klein would have wanted to curry favour with each of the Beatles doing whatever they wanted to do next.
Definitely.
Yeah, but given that, I wonder if Ringo would have been able to secure a leading role as the hero in a Western, which feels like it might have been, you know, more suited to what he might want to do. Don't know. Interesting.
I mean, maybe. But, you know, also, you know, this presupposes that he wanted to be the lead in anything. So bear in mind, like, he's been a pretty content, you know, sort of unfair to call him a side man. But,
that's,
you know,
true.
He's never really wanted to be front and centre in the Beatles or any of his creative pursuits. You know, he's been sort of, you know, Magic Christian, he was sort of, like, quite happy to be, you know, second fiddle to Peter Sellers. You
know, that's true. And also that goes along with, you know, he spent the last 10 years not being the Beatle in the spotlight. So maybe actually that would be, you know, playing to his comfort zone.
Yeah, I think he needed quite a lot of cajoling to do lead vocals and things like that. You know, it's that story about, I think, when he sang With a Little Help from My Friends, I think the others had to stand around and, like, really sort of be his cheerleader so he would hit the high note at the end.
Yeah.
You know, he was sort of quite uncomfortable with it in general. So, yeah, I suppose it makes sense, you know, in terms of personality, that he's not necessarily going to go out and say, I need to be the star, you know, the main, you know, the male lead in every film I do. You know, that makes sense, I guess.
Fun fact about the film, did you spot the cameos at the start?
I'm aware that those cameos are there, and I know who you're talking about, but no, I didn't spot them.
I feel like it's been very, very generous of you to leave the reveal to me. So both Alan Klein and Mal Evans are in the film right at the very start, when the blind man shoots the bell and wakes up his business partner, Skunk. We see Skunk wake up on a bed, which also contains two other men and a woman.
Oh, okay.
So the idea is presumably they've all had a lovely night.
Yeah.
Had a lovely time of it. And those two other men are Alan Klein and Mal Evans.
Right.
And as he gets waken up from his slumber by this attacked bell, we see Alan Klein and Mal Evans get up from the bed as well. And that's a nice, neat cameo. I can understand how Alan Klein got that role as producer on the film.
Yeah.
And also, at this point, it's worth pointing out that he was also Tony Anthony's manager, and had worked with him on Tony Anthony's previous spaghetti westerns as well. So they were very much sort of partners in that kind of genre of film before this one was made. I guess Mal was just visiting the set that day.
But I think, isn't he still working for Apple at this point? I'm not completely sure of the timeline, actually, whether he's still employed by Apple at this point.
Right.
But if so, what he'd be doing? I'm not sure.
Yeah. As Skunk's male bed partner.
Right, okay. It's probably not his official job description, but, you know.
No. Does anyone know what Mal's official job description is?
No, right. You know, it's like, you know, it's either that or go and find an anvil.
Yeah, exactly. Anvil wrangler. Okay, so we've gone straight into Ringo's role. We should probably do a little bit more of the basics and cover that. So Tony Anthony is the star. He's produced the film as well. Story came from him, story. This is off the back of a successful run of other spaghetti westerns that he has made, where he plays a similar kind of character, not blind, but sort of a stoic gunslinger type called The Stranger in a series of films. And obviously, he is him who's carrying this movie as the main central anti-hero for the film.
Yeah.
So given all of that, why does the film hate women so much?
Because it's because it's a Western and it was fine to hate women back then. No, it's I mean, you know, this film, like a lot of films of the 1970s and like a lot of Westerns in general, is not all that sympathetic to its female characters, it's fair to
this
say.
Is very much falling into the exploitation era of filmmaking as well. And I mean, I'm not hugely well versed in the genre of spaghetti Westerns, but a lot of this film reminded me of similar exploitation films from that period that were made in the horror genre.
Yeah, yeah.
So things like I Spit on Your Grave,
right.
Like those really low budget horror films that just seem to be made on the basis that there's a built-in excuse to show naked women get beaten up a lot and raped, essentially. And there's just a lot of that in the film.
Right.
And, you know, with context, those moments where, you know, there's nudity in the film and violence towards women in the film is justified because of the characters that are portrayed in the film.
Yeah.
So you could argue that overall the story in the film doesn't need to be that way, but they're written as necessary story points in the movie.
Right.
But the way that the film lingers on them is where it feels gratuitous. So there is like a 2.5 minute scene of naked women in a shower with just water getting poured over them and thrown at them.
Yeah.
And it's like, this doesn't need to be that long. I get it. You want them to be clean.
Sure.
And there's lots of that kind of thing. Like there's, you're playing to a certain kind of audience with this film who are, where there is a, I guess an interest, desire to see where the limits are pushed in certain areas in terms of sex and violence, which is just starting to happen in this decade.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, so that's sort of feature of this sort of era of 70s exploitation cinema, you know. So like Sam Peckinpah is doing this, at this point as well, and there's lots of it going on.
Definitely Straw Dog vibes on here.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so morally, it doesn't quite know where it stands, and like you're right to sort of try to draw the distinction between a film in which characters do sexist things and the film itself being sexist. That is not necessarily the same thing. Here it happens to be the same thing, but it is not always necessarily the same thing.
I'm right to make the hypothetical point.
But you are, but you know, I do think it is very confused about what its hero's sort of quest is here. So Blind Man is a gunslinger who has this contract to save these 50 mail order brides who are supposed to be going to be sold into like marriage with these Texan miners, but have been kidnapped somewhere along the way and instead are essentially sex slaves to these bunch of Mexican bandits. So his mission really is to rescue them from one type of sex slavery so he can, you know, claim money to sell them into another type of sex slavery. Yes. Now, sex slavery, generally frowned upon.
I think, yes, you're right.
I think it's fair to say. So you're not really sure who to root for. And I suppose these days, if you were doing something similar, it's fair to say, you know, there's lots of anti-heroes these days. You know, that's not something that was sort of unique to the 70s. But I do think those lines would be a bit more clearly drawn, you know?
Well, yeah, interesting, because I think that the whole film, and obviously, you know, this comes with the back of the spaghetti Western craze, which would have started from the Sergio Leone movies. For Clint Eastwood and The Man with No Name would have been like the archetype anti-hero for this type of film. I think the difference is that the cause tends to be more noble, and the journey to get to achieve that objective has a looser sense of justice.
Yes.
So what you might have is you've got an anti-hero whose goal is to either fulfill a job like this one, like in this film, or to try to get a lot of money, a pot of gold or whatever, or to get revenge on the death of a loved one or something, right? And it's like that's the ultimate objective of the film.
Yeah.
But along the way, he might take a bribe or steal something or act immoral towards a woman or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
This feels a little bit inverted because you've got the ultimate objective is to sell these women into these arranged marriages.
Yeah.
But along the way, you've got like a moment in the film where Pilar, who's the object of affection of Ringo Starr's character, Gandhi, at one point she leans in to kiss him. And he puts his hand up and says, no, not now. Because he's, at that point, not interested in taking advantage of her.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I'm glad you're not interested in taking advantage of her, but there's 50 women over here,
yeah.
which you're willing to sell for the contract amounts that you've been promised.
Yes. No. It's a grey area, isn't it, morally?
It's a huge grey area. What also confuses it are the allegiances he makes along the way, because the women are actually stolen by Domingo. Taking back a step, blind man has a business partner called Skunk.
Uh-huh.
Skunk allows women to be kidnapped by Domingo, the Mexican bandit. He uses these women as a lure to trap the general.
Yep.
Which he does and holds him hostage along with the women.
Yep.
And then Blind Man comes and frees the women and also frees the general at the same time.
Yeah.
The general who was lured because he was quite happy to capitalize on this idea of there being 50 women in this fortress that he would be able to, him and his men would be able to enjoy their own whim. So then there's this bond between the blind man and the general, even though they have different objectives with these women.
Mm.
You know, so it doesn't feel like anyone's really quite on the right side of justice here, I'll be honest.
No.
And then obviously all of that gets completely scuppered right at the very end of the film. The last frame is that the general has double-crossed the blind man and kidnapped the women again.
Yeah.
For his own means.
Yeah. And it should be pointed out, the general is a sort of overtly comic character as well. In that the
God damn you crazy gringo.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
He has his catchphrase.
Yeah. And just sort of laughs uproariously at lots and lots of things.
Everything.
There's a good comic scene where they have to escape by jumping off a roof, which is like about a 10-foot roof, and the blind man jumps onto his horse, and then the general tries to jump onto his horse, and the horse moves at the last minute, and he falls onto the ground, you know. So, yeah, the general is quite an odd character in that it's as if you're being set up to like him. And there are times when you think, oh, no, he's on the right side of everything. And then there are times you think, oh, no, he very much is not at all, you know.
And I think that's interesting, isn't it? Because, you're right. You're set up to like him because he's like a comedy accomplice in the overall story, even though his plans for this group of women are clearly nefarious.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons, going back to your point about how sometimes the characters being sexist can be a different thing to the film being sexist. But in this instance, they are the same thing, because the way that the overall group of 50 women are treated in the film is as a MacGuffin.
Yes.
They're very much treated as an object, as a thing that people want and use.
Oh, yeah.
Without there being any sort of broader depiction of what any one of those single women might actually be like or, you know, have any kind of personality they might have.
Yeah.
There's a scene towards the end as well where the blind man allows their captor, Domingo's sister, to get beaten up by the women.
Yes.
Like, so he frees the women and then basically allows her in the cage. And they all like scream and like crowd around her and start hitting her and stuff like that. And the expression that the blind man then gives is kind of like rolling his eyes, like, oh, women will be women. We're going to let them have their fun.
Yes.
And then eventually he shoots his gun a couple of times to get him to stop. And is like, you know, like, okay, now we need to get back to business.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very much just a weird sort of, you know, like they're absolutely rightly and justified. And what an interesting turn in the story to let them have their own revenge on the person who has, you know, treated them so horribly. But he doesn't even let them do that. It's just a, you know, oh, I'm going to let have this fun moment of, oh, women, eh? Cool.
Yeah. I suppose, while they're beating her up and shouting at her, I suppose maybe that means that the film technically passes the Bechdel test.
Oh, God.
But then, no, I suppose not technically.
Well, none of them speak, so I'm not sure that's
true. She's the only named female character, and her character is called Sweet Mama.
Yes.
So...
Well, no, to be fair, there's Pilar as well. That's
sorry, no, yes. You're quite right.
But Sweet Mama is. And we could probably just spend this entire episode listing all of the many moments which are questionable.
Yeah.
But again, Blind Man's anti-hero status, I'm not sure how that extends to when he eventually ties up Sweet Mama to a post. He lights some fuses as if he's going to kill her, but then makes sure that there's ample time for his brother to find her and free her anyway. But what he does after he ties her, as a blind man, is just copper feel straight away.
Yes.
Yeah. And then when she reacts badly to that, he gets aggressive and he just rips all the clothes off.
Yeah.
And I'm not really sure how that falls within the definition of an anti-hero, because we have this sense of he acts like he has the moral high ground a lot of the time.
Yes.
Very difficult to reconcile a lot of the scenes in here with that.
Yeah. So I do think that one of the ways in which it draws a kind of a moral line is that because we're told that the men who, like, these women are sort of, you know, destined for, you know, whatever your thoughts on mail order brides and essentially, you know, the selling of women into slavery, personally, I'm against it. whatever is happening there, you are told that it's miners who these women are kind of destined for, i.e. like salt of the earth guys types. And actually what's happened along the way is that they've been kidnapped by these sort of like rich, avaricious bandits.
Yes. You
know? And so there is a kind of injustice going on there, because, you know, I suppose not that you're supposed to think about it this deeply, but
else are we doing if not this?
Well, quite right, yeah. But if you're supposed to think anything about it at all, like, there does tend to be a general consensus in films that, like, rich people behave badly, rich people are greedy and have got there through cheating people in some way. That kind of tends to be, it's a sort of good shorthand for who is a good and bad person, you know. And so I suppose probably the road it's trying to go down is that even though we never meet any of these Texan miners, which might help a bit, like, they're probably like salt of the earth types who just want to, like, kick back after a hard day's mining and have sex with their mail order bride, you know.
Oh, fine. Of course.
They're
wrong. I mean, there is an element of, and my reading of this was that, and this is clearly problematic, but my reading of the film was that the 50 mail order brides were willing mail order brides.
Yeah,
you know, like, yeah. they weren't slaves.
Yes.
Who were then tied up and, you know, and forced to go to their new husbands.
Yeah.
Like, that is a path which they were willing participants in. They weren't trying to run away at any point. You know, they were. Where the blind man was supposed to be taking them was, as far as they were concerned, where they wanted to go next.
Right, yeah.
Again, problematic.
But I suppose at least, yeah, the idea being that at least they would be financially rewarded for that and live quite comfortably.
Oh, fine.
I suppose is what is trying to be said.
But let's move away from all of the messy business about the sex slavery.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Let's talk more about Japanese literature.
Sure. Finally.
I knew I was going to be able to seamlessly segue into this. So the character of Blind Man is clearly based on the Japanese legendary character of Zatoichi. there's been a very successful run of films and TV series based on this character, mm-hmm. and it is one that is a blind samurai. So the idea is that he almost possesses supernatural-like abilities despite his blindness,
mm-hmm.
but his proficiency with a sword and his strong sense of justice helps. So this is a spaghetti western that's based on that character, much mm-hmm. in the way that the Fist for the Dollars spaghetti western Leone movies are based on Yojimbo, sort of similar kind of like aimless Ronin samurai kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
They're all based in, from taking characters from, I guess, Japanese movies like the Kurosawa films, and then placing them in a sort of more Western, in this case, literally Western environment.
Yeah.
Now, I think that's a great idea. I think it's a interesting thing to do, to be able to take that character and transpose them into a completely different genre. I don't know how effective this film is in doing that.
Yes.
And I will tell you why.
Right.
Before you agree with me. The reason why the idea, the concept of that character works is because everyone who comes up against him underestimates that character mm. because of his blindness.
Mm-hmm.
And then he proves himself to have this incredible ability to fight regardless of his disability.
Yeah.
And it's this constant idea that he's meeting these bad guys and fighting against these villains and stuff who underestimate him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that happens in this film.
Yes.
I think many of the bad guys in this film estimate him.
Correctly estimate him. Yes. Yeah.
Estimate him the correct amount. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Because he often can't fight.
Yeah.
He often gets caught, kidnapped, tortured extensively.
Yeah.
He often wins battles through luck,
yeah,
or through other people saving him,
yeah.
And I feel like it does that sort of transposition of that legendary conceptual character a massive disservice.
Yeah, so I think you can go a bit further, actually. So it's not just that usually what happens in with these characters is that people underestimate them. It's that they underestimate them, and then their disability is actually an advantage. The story you're being told is that it gives them like a heightened sense of some kind. So you think about like Daredevil, the Marvel, the Marvel Comics character, who's been played on Netflix as well. And, recently, so a couple of weeks ago, we saw John Wick Chapter 4, in which Donnie Yen plays a sort of blind assassin.
Donnie Yen, who played a similar kind of character in John Wick 4 now, but also was probably seen for the most part by many audiences playing a very similar character in Rogue One, where he plays a character with Force-like abilities.
Of course.
Who's able to fend off against Imperial forces.
Yeah.
But very, very similar kind of character.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and so that tends to be what is suggested. Is not just that they have overcome this disadvantage, but that because of their lack of sight, they have like heightened sense of hearing, that kind of thing.
Mm.
So they can kind of orientate themselves around their environments. Donnie Yen is doing a lot of sort of tapping his cane on things to like, so, and when he hears the sound, he sort of understands where that thing is in the room and all this kind of stuff. Blind Man does not do this so much. So it kind of starts trying to do it. There's the opening scene of the film is really good and really atmospheric, I think, and played really well by Tony Anthony. So he sort of, we're introduced to him, introduced to his blindness by him sort of turning up in this village. And then he asks a guy, is there a church tower? And then he shoots the church tower bell. So that, and rings it, so that is supposed to suggest to you, oh, this guy actually has like sort of not supernatural, but like, abilities. He's a better shot than he would be if he could see.
But also just this idea of him having this very clear sense of sophisticated understanding of what is likely to be the case, right?
So
how that scene plays out is, is there a church here? Point me in the direction of the church. Is the priest rich? And the guy says yes, and he says okay, so he's likely to have a bell in it. So yeah. he's almost like he's deduced that actually this is a thing that he can do. So there's an ability there to like cleverly surmise what he could use to his advantage based on just him being clever.
Yeah, as opposed to just saying, does it have a bell?
Okay, yeah, actually, to be fair, that was more clever.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, it will do bits like this. But, you know, so he is capable of determining that there is a church bell across the street and shooting it in order to ring it. But he's at the same time incapable of detecting the fact that there's a snake in his salad.
Yes.
So, you know, at some point, you know, someone tries to assassinate him, but, you know, he's got like this bowl of salad leaves and then there's a snake in it. And then at a certain point, the snake hisses and he kind of stops and goes, Was that a snake?
That might have just been my lettuce.
Yeah. Like, no, I don't think so. And just carries on eating. And then, like, he doesn't... So the way you would expect this to be written is that at some point he does detect it and he kills the snake by just sort of identifying by its sound exactly where it is and then strangles it.
And then
it
using his own quick reflexes.
Yeah.
Completely, that's what I was expecting.
And it doesn't do that at all. No. He just sort of falls over.
No, he falls over, he flies into a panic. And then basically says, if this snake bites me, I will die.
But then
argues, if that happens, then you won't know what I've done with Pilar.
Please
save me from this snake. Right. Yeah. I completely agree. And that's it. And I think that there are moments in the film where what you were saying before about how, for example, Donnie Yen's character in John Wick 4 bangs his cane and he can tell where people are. And to be fair, like, you know, the example you gave about Daredevil is a little bit problematic because his powers are enhanced by a radioactive ooze. So it's not quite, you know, I mean, it's Marvel being Marvel, right?
He has
like a special sense of like echolocation or something. But in this film, I was aware of this throughout a lot of the fight scenes. A lot of the time, the people he fights are making noise. So there's a moment where a group of guys gang up on him. One's playing the guitar, they're laughing, they're shooting guns at him and stuff, and then he kills them all. And you could argue that the film is deliberately making them do something that would help him, work out where their location is so he can kill them effectively.
Yeah.
I don't think it's explicitly saying that, and I think it probably would need to if that's the point it's trying to make.
But
then elsewhere, it doesn't seem to help him at all. His final scuffle with Domingo is quite ham-fisted, I think.
Yeah.
The film has pitted Blind Man against Domingo all the way through.
Yeah.
And they finally have a climactic showdown where they end up fighting together in a barn. And actually what happens is, in order for Blind Man to eventually get the upper hand, the general appears out of nowhere and just stubs his cigar out on Domingo's eyes.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Right? which actually then lends itself to a nice move on the film's part where you've then got Domingo being blind for the first time, facing him off against the blind man, and then both scrabbling around for their guns and stuff.
Yeah.
What the film doesn't do is give the blind man a moment where he gets the upper hand himself, which I think it needs to, because that's the whole point of that kind of character, is to show that he is perfectly capable despite his disability.
Yeah.
But also effectively showing the contrast between someone who is newly blind and someone who has become effective despite being blind, because they both then spend 20 seconds searching for their guns. Neither of them is better off than the other, which I think is doing him a massive disservice,
because
early on in the film he's established as someone who's supposed to be quite calm and collected and very capable despite his blindness. So his problems all round, really. I don't know what else to say.
So it's a bit sexist, a bit ableist.
Yeah,
race though, it's fine.
Should we get on to race?
Sure.
Okay.
So obviously this is set in Mexico. Should make the point, by the way, that we've used the term spaghetti western quite a lot, but this is filmed in Spain, which arguably makes it more of a paella western, really.
Very good. Still made by an Italian director, though, I think, is where the term would come from. But if you want to make your paella joke, you go ahead.
Would you like me to repeat it so it works better in the edit?
Nope. I'm leaving all of this in.
Okay, fine, good. Race. So there are plenty of Italian actors in this who are not Hispanic, but I think it is fair to say can play sort of convincingly Mediterranean, if you like. Ringo Starr famously is not Mediterranean or Hispanic. It's one of the first things you notice about him, actually, when you see him. So, like, he's very tanned. And so, apparently, when he was out there, he didn't wear his watch or any of his rings so that his hands would sort of tan evenly. So, like...
It's commitment to a role, isn't it?
It's commitment to a role.
Taking your rings off.
Yeah, yeah. There is, at the near the end, when, spoiler alert, Ringo dies. And you see him, like, as a corpse at his funeral. And in order to, like, give his skin the necessary pallor, he effectively just has his own complexion.
Is that right?
I think so. Like, I don't think they've, like, whitened him up particularly. Yeah. They've just, you know, stopped browning him up, really.
Side note just on that scene is that you see him basically in an open casket, and his Domingo, his brother, sort of wipes his face with, like, a cloth a bit.
Right.
And you very, very visibly see Ringo's eyes tense during that scene, despite him supposedly being dead.
I missed that. So he's playing Mexican. He's doing the accent. I think the accent, like, if you say to me, "Oh, Ringo Starr's in this film and he's doing a Mexican accent," then, you know, my hopes are not high for how that's going to go. I think he makes a better fist of the accent than you would expect him to.
Yeah, I don't know what the problem is, really.
Yeah.
I mean, other than beyond the presumably huge offence that Mexicans would be watching it.
Yeah.
But overall, this feels very much in keeping of anyone doing a fair shout at a Mexican accent in this kind of film.
I think so. Yeah, there's a bit of Scouse kind of creeps through every now and again, but broadly speaking, he's making a pretty good job of it.
I actually think as well, he plays the character quite well. It's a good performance. It's quite a startling performance. Like, I think so. I think you'd be forgiven for watching this film and forgetting that it was Ringo Starr of the Beatles playing this character.
Yeah, that's true.
There are some moments where he has quite a sort of like a wide-eyed, crazed look, and it looks quite natural. There's a bit of like a soullessness but despondency kind of sort of expression that he wears as the character. There's also a very nice introduction to him. I think in his very first scene, he dunks his head in like a barrel full of water, and then lifts his head up to reveal his face as Ringo Starr. And I can't remember what his line is, but he gives a line that's kind of like a quick order to his henchmen. But then does like this sort of naturalistic thing where he just sort of like exhales, like, you know, gets like the last bit of water out of his mouth or something like that, and it's just quite a, like, he's a bit annoyed or he's a bit put out by the fact that it's, you know, he's soaking wet having dunked his head in water. But it feels quite natural, like, you know, we've talked before about how he does tend to be able to bring these sort of naturalistic performances to these characters. And I feel like it's true here, even though it's way beyond what you'd expect him to be able to do as an actor.
I think, I mean, this is, like, in terms of the performances of his I've seen, it's the one where he is the least recognizable, and that's completely to his credit. He is convincingly quite intense. Think a lot of the sort of close-up work he's required to do is where there is a kind of like wide-eyed fury or madness to him, and he is playing that quite convincingly in general, I think. You know, it's apparently, like, you know, what he tried to do was, I think he said something like, you know, what I came up with was to start every scene, you know, acting quite normally and then sort of build up to become a raving madman through it, you know, in each one. You can kind of see that, and it works, you know.
To be honest with you, I'm just quite impressed that he had like a strategy to his acting. This is how actors, you know, build out characters, isn't it? This is how they decide on being consistent in their portrayal of a character. The fact that he's actually taken a consistent approach to this performance is already, I think, already goes to show that he is committed to just acting generally and how he's sort of coming at these things in the right way.
Yeah, and this is sort of part of the reason why I think that this being a Western is not insignificant, and like Westerns being something that he loves so much, you know. Mm. It's the first time he's had the chance to act in one. And he is obviously giving it his all, you know. And he is obviously, you know, there's a seriousness about the way he's prepared for this character and the fact that, you know, he is approaching it like a good actor does, i.e. I have an idea for how I'm going to do this, as opposed to I'm going to show it. Here is the script and I'm going to read the lines in a way that sounds like how human beings talk. You know,
yeah.
I have thought about this character, what kind of person this character is, and I'm going to try and act like that person would act, you know. Is broadly how I understand acting works.
Yeah,
I
mean,
that's pretty, that's how Daniel Day-Lewis puts it, I think, yeah, more or less. You know.
There's a line in this where he's obsessed with this this young girl, Pilar, and one of the first lines he has with her basically is when he hits her and rapes her, ultimately, in the scene. But he forces her to undress.
Yep.
And he has a line where he says something like one of these days I'm going to light a fire under you just for you to have some warmth. And it's but it's like you can imagine that written down, that is a, you know, that would be an exasperated line, but he brings like a level of aggression to it as well, and like it's actually like it took me by surprise. It's like, oh, actually that's quite an interesting line reading, like that says a lot about the character that wouldn't have been on the page. So I feel like he's you can see he's bringing these things to the role.
I think we're in danger of sort of talking about his performance in like slightly too surprised tones. Not just like, oh, Ringo Starr's good in this film. Like, we know he's a good actor. We've seen him act before, and we've been complimentary about his acting before, and I'm sure we will be again. But but I think, you know, even the idea that he has sort of prepared for this in like not a method way, but in a sort of in the way that you would consider that a sort of quote unquote proper actor would.
Yeah, a serious dramatic actor would bring to his role. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I suppose, I mean, your use of the word dramatic there, I suppose, is quite interesting because maybe this is the first sort of properly dramatic thing he's had to do, you know. So obviously the Beatles films plus, you know, Magic Christian were quite knockabout capers, you know.
How do you think it compares to Tony Anthony's performance in the film? Obviously he's carrying the movie. It's a very interesting character. I think it's a compelling character.
Yeah.
I don't know whether or not he hits every sort of performance beat that he needs to in the film. There's quite a lot of sort of post-kill quipping going on that kind of fall a bit flat for me.
Yeah.
There are sort of lines where, what is it? There's a line where he says something like, when a girl has you by the short and curlies, you're done. You know, and even when he finds a snake in his food, he's like, what kind of son of a bitch puts a snake in a man's food? But it's really slow and deliberate and a bit forced. And I don't know, it's a character choice, but I don't think it works necessarily. I think he's going for a mix of, I think he's an infallible action hero with a sideline in being relaxed enough to joke about death as it happens.
Yeah.
But actually, his action hero is very, very fallible.
Yeah.
And his jokes aren't funny.
You know, when we were talking about Give My Regards to Broad Street, we were sort of wondering whether actually Ringo could have played the role of Harry in that, which is a sort of much more significant role. And actually, it is sort of interesting to think, could Ringo have played the role of the blind man in this? You know, would that have worked? Now, I mean, it's actually a role that just, it sort of requires a lot of stillness, if you like, you know. And that opening scene that I liked so much is really what he's conveying there is just this sort of like veneer of menace, you know. And he's speaking very quietly because he doesn't have to speak loudly in order to be get across the idea that he is threatening and dangerous, you know. Whereas I suppose like Ringo is sort of much more amped up, and you can tell that he's sort of out of control, and he's, you know, more of a loose cannon. And I suppose what you get from that is when the two of them are sort of adversaries, it is sort of more volatile. He's going to act much more on impulse, and eventually that's going to get him killed because he makes sort of poor decisions, you know. And actually, I was thinking, I wonder if this is the only time I've seen Ringo's character die in a film. So, you know, there are, I think, you know, certain stars you read about who have it written into their contract that they never die in a film.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure Ringo isn't one of them, but at the same time, it occurred to me that that was a very specific you know, not a choice on his part necessarily. But in terms of, like, you know, if you know, it's 1971, you know, the Beatles split up about, you know, a year or two ago. At this point, they're still, like, quite big stars in their own right. Getting Ringo Starr in your film is going to help sell it a little bit.
Yeah.
But also, you know, he's not, as we've said, he's not really the second lead as he's billed. He has, like, a fair amount of screen time, and his role is a significant one, but it's certainly not a huge one. And the fact that he dies might have been sort of quite a big deal at the time. Might have been, like, slightly shocking.
Yeah, I think there's you're right. It's probably shocking at this point to have seen Ringo die so explicitly.
Yeah,
because we actually see his corpse, no matter how much the eyes move.
Yeah.
but again, it probably is part and parcel of agreeing to play a character that isn't the central focus and the one who carries the movie.
Yeah, and I think it also helps with the idea that this is a bad guy he's playing, a bad guy who, like, in terms of the sort of the fairly black and white morality of films like this, deserved to die.
Yes.
You know, that's to say, you know, I mean, villains in films are sort of generally set up as being deserving of the death they end up with.
Yes,
know?
Yeah.
And he certainly is in this case, you know. And I think that actually marks it out as, I don't know about a unique performance. I haven't seen enough Ringo Starr performances yet to mark it out as unique. But it certainly feels like a bit of a line in the sand for, you know, what he is doing as an actor and sort of how he's thinking about his own star image. And sort of how he wants to take this career forward, you know. It doesn't feel to me like he has just taken sort of any old role that was available to him. And so even though it wasn't the biggest role in the film, he's, you know, been forced to go, okay, well, like, no one's offering me starring role, so I'll take this.
Yes.
It does feel like a sort of pretty rich opportunity for him to play quite a distinct character and do something with it, as opposed to just be Ringo Starr, in,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Going back to the murky moral ground that the film, you know, enjoys, I thought it was surprising to me that even knowing and being familiar with this kind of exploitation movie, it's very weird having Ringo in this film. And then what comes with that is the context of how progressive the Beatles were.
Yeah.
And it's weird to me. I think watching Ringo in this film made me think, oh God, how did this era of this type of movie happen after all of the progressive work that came with the Beatles' career a decade before?
Yeah.
You know, and I think partly that is because we tend to focus on the positives when we talk about the Beatles. We tend to focus on all the things that they did and assume that society moved along at the same pace as them. But yeah, it seemed quite shocking to me to have gone from sort of flower power, all you need is love, to quite a horrendous depiction of brutality against women in this film that Ringo is actively complicit in.
Yeah,
it actively complicit in the movie, not in the not in the actual.
Yeah, like, I'm glad you clarified.
Good,
that, you
know, just in case.
Just in case his lawyers are listening.
Yes, of course. Yeah,
as I'm sure. Yeah. No, I think. Like, it's an interesting point that this idea that, you know, sort of 5 years later, everyone was standing in a field singing All You Need Is Love. And now, you know, they're sort of, you know, shooting women in
that same field.
Yes, that's exactly what's happening. Yeah. No, but I think it's one of the things about the 60s as a revolution is that we tend to think of the 70s as a sort of fairly seedy time, you know, like when sort of like the drugs, like, moved from the sort of happy drugs like marijuana and LSD and into the sort of the harder ones like cocaine and heroin, you know. Yeah. And I think also that the 70s was sort of a time, especially in America, was sort of lost souls, if you like, who had sort of tried to find the answer with sort of gurus and cults and things like this, and had just been and failed to find it, just been turned loose, you know, it was just sort of like roaming around the country. There's lots and lots of homelessness and things like that. So, I mean, we tend to think of it as a time where everything was like quite seedy and quite dirty. But actually, the revolution of the 60s came about, part and parcel of it was the sort of permissiveness that came with it. And perhaps there's an argument that with that permissiveness also comes the permission to be like quite unpleasant.
Yeah, and I guess exploitation, as we mentioned or we touched on briefly before, was an experiment, if you were, in how far those boundaries could be pushed, particularly in terms of like film certification. And I think it's worth pointing out that there was a longer cut of this film that hasn't been released in the UK because it had to be edited down quite heavily for the BBFC in order to be released at all. So I think it came out in the UK months after its initial release in the rest of Europe. But I think there's a part of that that comes with exploitation movies, isn't it? The idea is, how sadistic can we get? How violent can we be?
Mm.
How sexualized can we be?
Mm.
And you can see that as being an extension from the initial permissiveness, like you say, that came about from the 60s flower power.
Mm. But these are taboos, and sort of art at this point is sort of pushing these taboos, So I mean, it's still a sort of fairly new idea. There still isn't really any swearing on television at this point. So I suppose that in terms of swearing even being included in recorded music, I suppose John Lennon's just done Working Class Hero around this time, has he? Which has an F bomb in it, So that's a bit new. But I think, in a sense, if cinema at this point is going to start pushing those boundaries and sort of exploring how much, sort of violence and sex it can put in, but the Western is sort of the obvious place where that is going to happen, it seems.
Literal Wild West, right?
Exactly.
Where there are, the entire films... is an entire genre is populated by outlaws, literal outlaws.
Yeah, and this is the appeal of Westerns and always has been, i.e. it's that sort of American libertarian ideal of this guy rides into town and just sorts everything out,
Yeah.
There's no state intervention, the mayor of this town is messing everything up, and actually what it needs is just one guy to come in with a firm hand, just to, ride into town, shoot a few guys, get a hooker, Clint Eastwood is the sort of ideal Hollywood Republican totem, in the same way that sort of Ronald Reagan was as well, to some degree, in that this is sort of what Westerns are all about. It is this libertarian idea of just taking decisive action, not relying on anyone else, doing everything yourself. So like within that, this is sort of part of the popularity of Westerns, is maybe the idea that this is a place where you could do whatever you wanted, so it makes complete sense now that the 70s are getting going, and everyone is now on heroin and having lots of really unpleasant casual sex, it makes sense that this is the landscape, the cinematic landscape, on which these kind of fantasies and narratives are going to play out.
So following that extremely good point about the cinematic landscape of the Western during the 70s.
Thank you.
What do you think of the song that Ringo Starr wrote for this film? So he wrote Blind Man for the film.
Yeah.
It is a song that appears on Goodnight Vienna.
Yep.
The lyrics of the song very much tell the story of what happens in this film.
Mm.
And from what I could find out online, the song was rejected from use in the film.
Yeah.
It seems a shame if you've built the song around the film. And obviously the recording of it is very much in the same style. Like it has a sort of country and Western feel to it.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a shame. I think it was like a lot of effort to have gone into it.
Sorry, I was laughing to myself because it just occurred to me that like wouldn't it be funny if like for the film Men in Black, like Will Smith had written the song Men in Black, and they said, I'm not sure this works actually, Will. What am I supposed to do with it now? Like,
there were lots of examples of that I can think of to back that up, but all of them also feature Will Smith.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that was very much what he was up to in the 90s, is writing the theme tune for his own films. And fair play to him, he did quite well out of it.
It does feel a little bit like, yeah, you're right, I think Will Smith has mastered the art of the movie song tie-in, and I think he's the way that he was able to do that was to approach it in the correct way, which was, would you like me to write a song for this? Get permission first.
Yeah.
And then go and write the song.
Yes.
It doesn't feel like that's what happened with Ringo.
No. No, I'm not sure it's his best work, to be honest. So I think it eventually ends up on the B side of Back Off Boogaloo.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's I wasn't really familiar with the song. I listened to it last night, and it's not melodically. It doesn't particularly go anywhere. I think it's fair to say.
There's a little bit of my favorite part of it is there is a moment in the song where the meter doesn't quite work, and at least for my listening to it, it feels like there are too many syllables in one particular line.
Yeah,
and where Ringo double tracks his voice, he's got two vocals that he's singing at the same time. They both kind of fall out of sync with each other during this one particular line, and then one of those tracked vocals, he just ends up giving up on at that point halfway through and doesn't come back into it again for a few lines later. And I just feel like, I mean, I don't know, like obviously at this point of recording, that is something that anyone would have picked up on, said, do you want to do another take? Like, like there is no reason for during the recording of this song for him to have made a mistake and to have got out of time with himself, and then to like sort of clumsily just not sing that line anymore and just come in a few lines later.
Yeah.
But in my mind, that is exactly what has happened when I listen to that song, because it just seems like he just didn't get the rhythm right because there's just too many syllables.
So gave up.
Anyway, feel free to look up that song, Blind Man, on Goodnight Vienna, and you know, let us know if you agree that that's what's happened. So I think on the whole, the film starts with a really good concept in this idea of translating the Zatoichi character into a Western. And I enjoyed watching this film for the novelty of watching a Western, because I don't tend to do that often.
Yeah, me neither.
But I did find there were a lot of flaws in it. I feel like it could have been... I feel like this whole notion of exploitation-era filmmaking is always problematic anyway, but I think what comes with that is a low budget, and with a low budget tends to come some sort of script problems. I think there are moments in this film that frustrated me a bit. There's a point where Blind Man somehow managed to get hold of an entire train at his disposal with which to transport these women, which he's presumably held up, but that happens off screen.
Yeah,
and it feels like that would have been quite an interesting thing to have seen some of, you know.
Yeah,
there were just moments like that, and you know, I think some of the lines could have done more work. So I kind of got a little bit frustrated throughout. I was impressed with Ringo's performance, and I liked the idea of the film, but overall I was left a little bit cold by this, just the period of which it was made, you know, and how that tends to mean that there are elements of this kind of film that I just don't enjoy particularly.
Yeah.
How did you find it?
Well, I mean, I'm not a big Westerns fan in general. I do. It is a genre that does tend to sort of leave me a little bit cold. On the whole, I enjoyed this much more than I was expecting to. I expected to find it like a bit of a laugh, as much as anything else. I thought there were some really convincingly intense performances in it. You know, Ringo's being one that is absolutely deserving of praise. I think Lloyd Batista, who plays Domingo, is really excellent. I mean, I think that roles like that, where you're a Mexican bandit and you're sort of in control, and then you sort of lose a bit of control because the hero is threatening you, it's very easy to slip into cliche. And I didn't think he slipped into cliche. There are absolutely times when the film itself slips into cliche, but I didn't think he did. Of course, like the film's morals and its politics are absolutely all over the place. But there are like some quite satisfying twists in it. That scene on the train that you're talking about is where Blind Man has, you know, seemingly managed to get these women all on the train. It's then revealed that they aren't the women he thought they'd be, which is a twist that I didn't see coming at all. You know, so there are bits where they sort of use his blindness in a way to sort of come up with these twists. There are, as we've discussed, a lot of places, far too many places, where they don't make use of the sort of central gimmick that this is a blind man who is a skilled, you know, gunslinger, in a way that just with a bit of tightening up would have been quite easy to achieve, you know.
So I think that it sounds like we agree this is a capable, effective Western that just has some significant fundamental flaws.
Yep.
If anyone at home has watched the film, do you agree with us or are we goddamn crazy gringos? Let us know by contacting us on all the usual social media platforms. We are at Beatles Films Pod. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast episode, why not leave us a review or a 5-star rating on your streaming platform of choice? Otherwise, we'll see you again next week for another episode. And until then, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
A change of seasons means adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow, or all of the above on the same day. This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. With all-condition traction and materials and features to keep you comfy and dry no matter what, you'll be ready for anything. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. Allbirds.com, code FRESHSOCKS.